From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. Former President Trump will not get his Facebook and Instagram accounts back for now. That's the ruling today from Facebook's oversight board, which banned Trump indefinitely in January, saying he used his accounts to incite the violent insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. In a statement, Trump did not address that decision directly, but he said the actions of Facebook, Twitter, and Google are, quote, a total disgrace and an embarrassment to our country. He added that these corrupt social media companies must pay a political price. We want to note that Facebook is a financial supporter of NPR. And let's bring in NPR's technology correspondent, Shannon Bond, who joins us with the details. Hi, Shannon.
Hi, Tanya.
Well, first, how surprising was this announcement? What kinds of reactions are you hearing so far?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think this was a bit surprising because the question that Facebook had put to this oversight board was, you know, should it have suspended former President Trump or not? And what the board came back and said was, yes, this suspension was justified given what happened on January 6th. But what the board said was that the company was wrong to impose an indefinite suspension. So that's not something that Facebook generally does. Usually it tells the user you're suspended for, you know, 30 days or 2 weeks, or you're banned entirely. And so now the board has said Facebook has 6 months to either ban Trump permanently or reinstate him or set a time limit on this suspension. And in terms of the response, I mean, you had a lot of critics of Facebook who were quite worried that he was going to be allowed back on. They said this ban was long overdue. And they're saying, you know, it's good that the board has upheld this suspension, but they're criticizing essentially that this is being punted back to Facebook and saying that that underscores that this board is not really a mechanism for true accountability for Facebook and the decisions that it makes.
This wasn't just a written ruling. The oversight board actually spoke about this.
That's right. Here is what co-chair Helle Thorning-Schmidt, she's the former prime minister of Denmark, here's what she said on a call with reporters.
Anyone who is concerned about Facebook's excessive concentration of power should welcome the oversight board clearly telling Facebook that they cannot invent new unwritten rules when it suits them.
What she's saying there is part of the issue is that Facebook's rules, you know, don't have a section for indefinite suspensions, that it couldn't really point to anything in its existing rules to justify the way it treated Trump. And so what the oversight board is also asking for is just more transparency and clarity about how its rules work and what kind of punishments or penalties get issued to users, whoever they are, when they break those rules.
Okay, we heard from the Prime Minister of Denmark. Remind us who else is on the oversight board and what their task was in terms of this issue.
Right. So the board is made up of 20 international experts. These are specialists in law and human rights. There's a Nobel Peace Laureate. The idea is the board is this sort of final arbiter of the hardest decisions that Facebook is making about the content that users can post. And so, you know, in this case where Facebook decided to suspend Trump after the January 6th attack on the Capitol, it said to the board, you know, this is exactly the kind of case we've created you to review. We want to know, do you think we were correct to make this decision according to our rules? And then it also asked for recommendations on how in general it should treat high profile political leaders and these kinds of circumstances.
So what does this actually mean now for former President Trump's ability to speak to his supporters?
Well, you know, he's been effectively cut off from the big social media platforms, you know, for almost 4 months now. You know, he's been permanently banned from Twitter, which is, of course, what he used really as a megaphone. You know, Facebook and Instagram were really important to Trump as fundraising platforms. And, you know, he's been absent there as well. You know, of course, you know, he is the former president. You know, he's been on TV. He's been on the radio. He's been issuing press releases. Yesterday, he launched a new blog where he's sort of posting many of the kinds of things he used to post on Twitter and Facebook, and people have the ability to share those to Twitter and Facebook. So he doesn't have any shortage of channels to reach people. But, you know, he is cut off from these very powerful platforms. And that, you know, that's kind of this core question here is who gets to make those decisions?
Well, yes. What does this actually mean long term for Facebook? We know there have been calls to increase regulation for tech companies overall from both sides of the aisle in Congress. Is this a more complicated world for Facebook and CEO Mark Zuckerberg?
Yeah, I mean, I think we are going to see increasing calls for exactly that kind of government regulation. And look, this decision, you know, this ruling from the oversight board basically puts this decision back to Facebook, which was always the one that really had to make it. And Facebook and Zuckerberg himself have said, you know, its critics have a point. It is also concerned about this kind of power being concentrated in the hands of a private company. That's why it created this board in the first place. And it said it is open to government regulation. But of course, you know, the distance between saying you're open to government regulation and what that regulation actually looks like can be quite vast.
That's NPR technology correspondent Shannon Bond. Shannon, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Tanya.
Well, let's take a look now at that special report from the American Heart and American Stroke Associations that found that that rare blood clot condition that affected a small number of people who got the Johnson & Johnson COVID-19 vaccine is a bigger risk from COVID-19 itself. In fact, the risk of getting the clot from COVID-19 is 8 to 10 times greater than the risk of getting it from the vaccine. Dr. Karen Fury authored the report. She's neurologist in chief at Rhode Island Hospital and the chair of neurology at the Warren Alpert Medical School of Brown University. Dr. Fury, let's restate, the risk of this clot, either from the vaccine or from COVID, is extremely rare.
Robin, that's exactly right. The vaccine caused cerebral venous sinus thrombosis in 6 patients who received the J&J vaccine in the U.S. The background incidence of CVST is 5 per million per year. So this is an extremely rare condition, even without COVID or vaccination entering into the discussion. We don't know for certain that there's a direct causal relationship between this condition and having received the vaccination.
Well, do we know if there's a causal relationship between getting COVID-19 and getting the clot? Because as the study found out, it's 8 to 10 times a higher risk. But is it also connected to COVID?
That association is much stronger. Patients who are infected with COVID-19 are at higher risk of forming clots. As a vascular neurologist, we saw many cases of stroke in unusual populations caused directly by COVID-19 infection. So as a result, we thought it was very important to get the public health message out that patients shouldn't be hesitant to get the vaccine, and that in fact, their risk of forming clots in the body, and particularly in the brain, is actually higher with COVID-19 infection than with any type of intervention to prevent it.
Yeah. The vaccine is still the far lower risk, and it's preventative, actually, when it comes to clots that you might get from COVID. But do we know why there are these rare blood clots associated with COVID?
When the cases first started appearing, people speculated that the acute inflammatory reaction that the body developed in response to COVID-19 infection led to clot formation. More recently, though, investigators have been exploring the effects of COVID-19 infection on the endothelial cells that line the blood vessels throughout the body. And it may be that the spike protein by which the virus binds to cells in the body may directly affect these types of cells and damage blood vessels.
And do we know why it's more common in women between the ages of 18 and 48, at least in those rare cases during vaccination?
No, that's one of the intriguing and troubling aspects of this. Cerebral venous sinus thrombosis overall is more common in women, particularly young and middle-aged women. And there's often a hormonal effect, either by the use of oral contraceptives or pregnancy. So it's unclear in the cases that have been reported whether there may be premorbid conditions or other elements that predisposed women to this condition. And it's certainly going to be something that we continue to follow and investigate.
Okay, so in summary, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is actually preventive of blood clots that you can get more often from COVID-19 than you can get from the vaccine. We also know that there are symptoms that doctors can look for after somebody's had the vaccine or COVID-19. If you could tell us a couple of those and also tell us the other directions. It's counterintuitive. There's something that doctors are not supposed to give patients when they get these clots.
Patients who develop cerebral venous sinus thrombosis presented with headaches that started several days after the vaccine. The headaches tend to be progressive and they don't respond to analgesics. CVST can also cause increased pressure in the brain, and that can cause strokes. So any focal neurological symptoms may be an indication of clots. So certainly, if anyone develops an unusual headache or any neurological symptom, they should report that to their physician or go directly to an emergency room.
but they should not take what?
The traditional therapy for cerebral venous sinus thrombosis was heparin. Heparin is a blood thinner. In this condition, the platelet count in the body goes down. This is similar to a condition called heparin-induced thrombocytopenia, and it can be exacerbated by giving heparin. So the management of this condition is very different than what we traditionally do, and doctors will have to use an alternative form of a blood thinner.
Okay, but again, very, very rare. Dr. Karen Furey, neurologist in chief at Rhode Island Hospital, chair of neurology at the Warren Alpert Medical School of Brown University. Dr. Furey, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you, Robin.
Brazil's President Jair Bolsonaro today defended his government's response to the pandemic that has killed more than 410,000 Brazilians. He spoke as a Senate inquiry hears from some of his critics who are blasting his response. NPR's Philip Reeves is in Rio, and he joins us now. And Phil, what exactly did President Bolsonaro say in this speech?
Well, Brazil's got a vaccine shortage and vaccinations here are going very slowly. So the only way to slow transmission right now is through restrictions and isolation measures. And that's what governors and mayors have been trying to do. Bolsonaro's fiercely against this because of the social and economic cost. And today in his speech, he threatened to introduce a decree guaranteeing the right to free movement, one that he said can't be challenged in court. Medical specialists will be appalled. He said it before, but, you know, the timing of this is significant. Everyone here remembers how Bolsonaro at first denied the virus was a serious threat, how he blocked purchases of vaccines last year, how he's promoted the anti-malarial drug chloroquine as a cure, even though doctors say it doesn't work against COVID. Now, all of that behavior by Bolsonaro is right now under the spotlight in this parliamentary inquiry.
Right. And lawmakers are listening to critics who are laying out a lot of what you just laid out for us. What else are they telling this panel?
Well, Bolsonaro's had four different health ministers during this pandemic. Yesterday, we heard from the first, who he sacked back in April last year. His name is Luiz Henrique Mandetta. Mandetta said he warned Bolsonaro back then that the pandemic could be devastating and that ignoring science was dangerous. He said he wrote a letter to Bolsonaro urging him to change his approach and to follow health ministry recommendations. And he said that if he didn't do that, there could be extremely grave consequences for Brazilians. Also, in a kind of compelling detail, Mandetta said he attended a meeting in which Bolsonaro wanted to change the labeling on chloroquine packets to call it, actually specifically to call it, anti-COVID treatment, which, we all know, it isn't. That was eventually nixed by the health regulators. And today, Bolsonaro's second pandemic health minister is testifying. He quit after less than a month after discovering that Bolsonaro was expanding the production of chloroquine.
Does Bolsonaro's response today show that he's worried politically? Do you think that this will hurt him politically in this next election?
Yeah, there's an election next year, and this is having a huge influence on these proceedings. Only a minority of the senators sitting in this inquiry support Bolsonaro's government. These pro-government senators are doing all they can to divert attention from his behavior and focus it on governors and mayors over the overcharging for COVID facilities, for example, and the theft of funds. So I think that strategy and Bolsonaro's threat today is a clear sign that he's worried.
I have just about a minute with you, but politics aside, this pandemic is taking a terrible toll there, as you said off the top. Why is the country so short on vaccines, and is the U.S. trying to help increase the vaccine supply?
Well, the Brazilians are asking the U.S. for more vaccines. It's short on vaccines largely because it's having supply problems, particularly from China. China makes the main ingredient for CoronaVac, which is the vaccine that so far has been most commonly used here. In the last few months, this just been a terrible tragedy here. We've seen people dying while waiting for IC beds, patients being tied to their beds with their arms because of a lack of sedatives, people suffocating in January in Manaus in the north because they were out of oxygen cylinders. Now, because of recent lockdowns, the number of deaths here have tailed off in the last couple of weeks. But yesterday, you know, we had another 3,000 deaths and 70,000+ cases, new cases. With vaccinations proceeding very slowly, I think it's going to get worse here before it gets better.
NPR's Philip Reeves in Rio, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Here's a pandemic statistic for you. Four people, Jeff Bezos of Amazon and the three sibling heirs to the Walmart fortune, these four people grew their wealth $114 billion in the last year, 35 times the hazard pay that went to the Amazon and Walmart workers that work for them. Now, economists are forecasting a post-pandemic economic boom in the U.S. between declining COVID cases and trillions of dollars in government spending. But the pandemic also is turbocharging inequality. President Biden pointed this out in his address to Congress last week.
20 million Americans lost their job in the pandemic, working and middle-class Americans. At the same time, roughly 650 billionaires in America saw their net worth increase by more than $1 trillion in the same exact period. Let me say it again. 650 people increased their wealth by more than $1 trillion during this pandemic. And they're now worth more than $4 trillion.
All this trillions and billions. What does it mean for the post-pandemic economy? Molly Kinder is a fellow at the Brookings Institution. And Molly, I stole that lead line from you and your co-writer, Laura Stadler, about Jeff Bezos from Amazon and the Walton siblings, Alice, Jim, and Rob, heirs to Walmart. They saw a 56% increase in their fortunes. We know that everybody used Amazon. Tons of people went to Walmart as they lived at home. We're going to get back to questions about both of them, but who are these other 650 billionaires who made, you know, $1 trillion during the pandemic? Don't name them all, but are they different from the billionaires whose wealth was already soaring? You know, how did they make so much money?
Well, the headline there is that the ultra-rich have gotten even richer during the pandemic, at the same time that so many Americans have fallen further behind and risked so much. The ultra-rich within the ultra-rich are the real winners. Just 20 billionaires account for about 75% of that wealth increase. 15 of those are in tech. So the really, really big winners of this pandemic have been the large tech companies like Google and Facebook and Amazon and Microsoft, which is why their founders' wealth has gone up so much. And what's also interesting is who are some of those new entrants to the billionaire class? And what I found interesting was that about 40 of them made that wealth fighting COVID. So some of the big names behind the vaccines, PPE companies, and diagnostic tests, some of that has led to some real wealth at the top for about 40 new billionaires.
Look, this is America. You can make money, and people will applaud you for that. But as you say, Jeff Bezos, the Walton siblings could have halved the billions they made, given it back to workers in some kind of compensation for the work they did taking a risk during pandemic times, and still have made billions of dollars. Talk about that gap right there.
I don't think anyone would be surprised to hear that Amazon is one of the biggest winners in terms of companies during the pandemic. Those profits are up 250% since the previous year because so many Americans have and folks around the world have turned to shop at Amazon. Amazon has given very little of that pandemic profit back to their workers. We calculated, my colleague Laura Stadler and I calculated that through the end of the year, their hazard pay they gave workers was only about $1 an hour if you averaged it since the start of the pandemic. But it stopped. They've given nothing since the new year. At Walmart, it's even less. So here these millions of workers have risked their lives. Their company have reported absolutely record profits. The billionaire founders have grown. I mean, Jeff Bezos has grown $80 billion richer. And a typical Amazon worker made less than $1 extra an hour as they're on the front line risking their lives.
Yeah. There are other companies, Costco, you draw attention to, that didn't make the big deal that Walmart and Amazon might have made about their workers. We saw the TV ads. They call them heroes. But they actually gave them more money. Look, you also mentioned the stock market, and we want to rush to say that part of the huge gains in the stock market had to do with the Fed holding down interest rates. But that also meant that people who were not in the stock market, whose money may be in savings accounts, they made very little on the interest on their savings accounts. So there's a gap there. Talk about government policies adding to the gap.
Absolutely. So I don't think there's any question that the Biden administration has tried very hard to support financially struggling households through direct payments, stimulus checks. However, some of that fiscal spending, those huge stimulus bills, have ultimately increased the disparities. The wealthiest 10% of U.S. households hold 87% of all stocks and mutual funds. So when the stock market is buoyed by a lot of the stimulus spending by the government, ultimately, it's often some of the wealthiest households that benefit the most. So that inequality that was already so pronounced before the pandemic is even more accentuated a year in.
So what do you see going forward? We know President Biden is proposing all these new policies that he says will help rein in inequality, including more enforcement against rich people cheating on their taxes. He's also proposing taxing the super, super wealthy in this country a lot more to pay for some of the plans going forward. Do you think if Americans are maybe more aware of the gap, they would get more behind that?
You know, I think so. I think all of our eyes during the pandemic have been opened to just the extraordinary inequality that has been experienced. You know, we've all clapped for essential workers. Well, you know, that essential work that kept us all afloat this whole year has been disproportionately shouldered by workers who make very low wages. 18 million adults just in March reported that they struggled to get enough food to eat. You know, one in three adults just in March had trouble paying just their normal household expenses. So I think Americans have seen more clearly some of this inequality. And in fact, public opinion polls shows there is a lot of support for both raising the minimum wage and there's widespread support for taxing the super rich and taxing corporations to pay the fair share.
Molly Kinder, a fellow at the Brookings Institution, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
A few years ago, a website popped up in Stockton, California, and conspiracy theories started ramping way up.
And it's being funded by a conservative movement underneath the table.
And I was like, oh my gosh, you guys, people really believe this.
What happens when the local news outlet isn't fact-checking conspiracy theories? Maybe encouraging them. Listen now from NPR's Invisibilia podcast.
Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, the World Health Organization's Director General, will run for a second term in next year's election, according to our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication. Born in Ethiopia, Dr. Tedros was elected to the position in 2017 when he made history as the first African elected to the WHO's top job. STAT's Helen Branswell has taken a look at his tenure. Helen, we know he responded to the Ebola outbreak in the northeastern corner of the Democratic Republic of the Congo, a terrible time. Now we're in a pandemic. Remind us of his tenure, but also the feeling about how he's handling COVID-19.
So a lot of his tenure has been taken up, publicly at least, with health crises, particularly the ones you've mentioned. There have been sort of back-to-back-to-back-to-back Ebola outbreaks over the last few years, one of which was the second worst on record. And, you know, he was heavily involved and, you know, I think was quite admired for that. In the pandemic as well, you know, he has been very front and center, although the agency did take quite a bit of criticism, still does, for their early handling of the pandemic. You know, there was the sense that perhaps if they had pushed China harder, the world might have been better prepared. A lot of that criticism was leveled by the Trump administration, which downplayed the significance of the pandemic even after it was declared. So, you know, it's not 100% clear that anything that they would have done early on would have made a huge difference here.
Well, we should say that President Trump withdrew the U.S. from the WHO, something President Biden rescinded, you know, when he took office. But there was a lot of blame thrown at the WHO, as you're saying, maybe unfairly. But what does it mean that he's running again? I mean, what does it matter who heads the WHO?
You know, I think it matters a lot. The agency has quite limited powers. The WHO functions under rules written for it by its member states, one of which has been the United States. It can't sort of march into a country and investigate something. It has to be invited, and it has to act according to the, you know, the wishes of the country when it's there. Still, it has a lot of moral sway internationally. You know, it's heavily involved right now in trying to secure vaccine for countries that don't have production capacity. Dr. Tedros, in particular, has been really pushing this issue and, you know, making the point that it is completely unfair that sort of a dozen countries in the world are using most of the vaccine now, and many countries have, you know, had enough doses for potentially like 1 or 2% of their populations. So, you know, that job can play a very important role. It is common for director generals to seek a second term. It's uncommon for them not to. They're only allowed to serve two. But he has to be elected. The way this works is other people could throw their hat into the ring, and if they do, there will be an election process.
Yeah. That's Helen Branswell from Stat News saying that what she's hearing is that the current head of the WHO, Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, will run again for the head of that organization. Of course, he hasn't formally announced that, and he will have to be elected. He may have competition. We'll see. But Helen Branswell, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
The American Psychiatric Association is trying to overcome its history. It was only in 1973 that it removed homosexuality as an illness. Only last January that it apologized for its racist legacy. For instance, psychiatrists diagnosed enslaved people with drapetomania, a disease they said caused Negroes to run away. Last summer, the APA released a report detailing its racist history, and last weekend, 10,000 members virtually attended the group's annual meeting focused on racism for the first time. Now, how to go forward when Black patients are less likely to get proper treatment for depression and Black psychiatrists are few? Dr. Cheryl Wills is one. She chaired the APA's Task Force on Racism in Psychiatry. Welcome, Dr. Wills.
Thank you.
You know, we've been stunned by some of the things we're reading. A statement from American psychiatrists in the 1800s that emancipation suddenly made many Black slaves lunatics when they hadn't been so during slavery. Remind us of some ways your profession has misdiagnosed Black people.
Well, the studies are clear. We'll start with psychosis and schizophrenia. A Black male and a white male who walk into a clinic or hospital to be evaluated with consistent or similar symptoms and a similar demeanor in clinical presentation, the Black male is more likely to be diagnosed with a psychosis spectrum disorder like schizophrenia. And this has been shown in study after study. And that's not right. You also see that there are studies that African-American children are more likely than other peers, similar age, similar situation, to be prescribed antipsychotic medications that can have debilitating short and long-term side effects.
On the other hand, studies show that Blacks are less likely to get the treatment, the medication they do need for things like depression.
Absolutely. And I believe parity is a part of that, where we have a disproportionate number of psychiatrists who engage in private practice because we're not on equal footing with reimbursement. In this day and age, with COVID and people losing their jobs or losing their insurance benefits, et cetera, it's become a huge problem. It continues to grow, and people are not able to get the type and quality of mental health services they require in an affordable manner.
Well, underscoring what you just said, many psychiatrists don't participate in insurance plans, and that's because they say that their reimbursement is too low. And a study in 2019 did show that primary care physicians are almost 24% higher in their reimbursement than that for mental health practitioners. This disproportionately affects people who don't have the cash, don't have the money to pay for mental health. And I just want to also add that, you know, when you were talking about the Black man and the white man both walk into a room exhibiting the same behavior, from my understanding, the profession has pathologized Black behavior. So an angry Black man is schizophrenic. An angry white man is angry.
Right. And part of that has to do with cultural humility. When we learn in psychiatry how to approach patients and how to be open-minded, understanding, and being willing to learn and understand their positions, We should not be prescribing medication until we understand the patient and the barriers to access, the barriers to continuity of care, etc.
Well, this racism within psychiatry, it goes back centuries to Dr. Benjamin Rush, who we read is widely considered to be the father of psychiatry, who thought that Black people had dark skin because they had leprosy. It's just kind of insane. But bring us up to this moment. Now you have Blacks across the board skeptical of the American medical world. It's affected them in times of COVID and whether or not they would take a shot. And I'm wondering if you see it affecting them in a time of racial reckoning when they're seeing people who look like them murdered on videotape. What does it mean if Blacks are distrustful of psychiatry at a time when they might need the services more than ever?
Stigma is a huge problem, and that's for all patients. But when we add on the serial traumatization that is impacting society, particularly Black and brown people, at the hands of law enforcement and otherwise, it becomes increasingly important to make mental health services accessible and user-friendly. It's a process. Not everybody's going to buy into it. But when we think about the consequences of not providing those services, it's incumbent for us to do what's necessary, not just psychiatrists, but medicine in general, to improve the access to care, the affordability of psychiatric care, and the quality of psychiatric care. Accessibility involves increasing the diversity of the psychiatric workforce, which involves recruiting people at an earlier age. And we have a Black Men in Psychiatry program at the APA, which is designed to recruit college students. They get mentorship, they get to come to meetings, they get to meet leaders in the field, etc. And we hope that this will work towards increasing the number of minority psychiatrists in the workforce. We need those types of services, those types of perspectives. But we also need people who have lived experience to contribute to that group and offer education, support, training, modeling, so that people can understand that there is no one type of psychiatry, one type of Black person, one type of psychiatrist. And we need to be open to that and willing to learn from our colleagues and from our patients and from the community.
Psychiatrist Cheryl Wills, chair of the American Psychiatric Association's Task Force on Racism. We'll link you up to all sorts of reading at hearandnow.org. Dr. Wills, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Wyoming Congresswoman Liz Cheney is the third highest-ranking House Republican. She's also one of the party's fiercest critics of former President Trump for his undermining of the 2020 election and incitement of the January 6th Capitol riot. NPR congressional correspondent Susan Davis reports in this piece that first aired on All Things Considered that a growing number of House Republicans say these two roles are incompatible.
It's not just that Congresswoman Liz Cheney voted to impeach former President Trump. It's that as the leader in charge of the party's messaging, she simply refuses to stop speaking out against him.
Somebody who has provoked an attack on the United States Capitol to prevent the counting of electoral votes, which resulted in five people dying, who refused to stand up immediately when he was asked and stop the violence, that is a person who does not have a role as a leader of our party going forward.
House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy long ago walked back his initial criticism of Trump's role in the January 6th attack, but Cheney has been relentless. On Monday, when Trump once again baselessly questioned the integrity of the 2020 election, she tweeted in response, quote, "The 2020 presidential election was not stolen. Anyone who claims it was is spreading the big lie." Last month, she made clear Trump was not welcome at House Republicans' annual retreat in Florida. She also broke with party leaders who are blocking an investigative commission into the January 6th attack because they wanted to also look at violence around the racial justice protests last summer. Democrats say that's a distraction. Cheney agrees.
I think that's a different set of issues, a different set of problems, and a different set of solutions.
The strain is starting to show. McCarthy initially rallied behind Cheney when a faction of the rank and file tried to throw her out of her leadership job after the impeachment vote. His support helped her beat back the effort by a more than 2-to-1 margin on a secret ballot back in February. But McCarthy told Fox News that Cheney's messaging is becoming a problem.
I have heard from members concerned about her ability to carry out the job as conference chair, to carry out the message. We all need to be working as one.
Minority Whip Steve Scalise told Axios in an interview that Cheney's views on Trump are out of step with most Republicans.
This idea that, you just disregard President Trump is not where we are. And frankly, he has a lot to offer still and has offered a lot. He wants to help us win the House back.
No House Republican has yet to call for another referendum vote on her leadership position. Back home in Wyoming, she's been censured by the state Republican Party for her impeachment vote and is facing a primary challenge for her seat. Trump plans to campaign against her. But she's posting strong fundraising numbers for her reelection campaign and still has the support of Republicans like former Speaker Paul Ryan. Professor Jim King of the University of Wyoming says her opposition to Trump hasn't ruined her political fortunes, but it has changed them.
You know, she may not any longer be on track to be speaker, but I don't see that she's in a position where she's going to lose in Wyoming.
Cheney's office did not respond to requests for comment, but it's clear she has no plans to lower her voice. She recently told the New York Post that she has not ruled out a future presidential run for herself one day. Susan Davis, NPR News, Washington.
Behind every stellar piano player you see on stage, there's an equally seasoned piano tuner who makes these instruments sound the way they're supposed to sound. But while we know that musicians have had a tough year without concerts at arenas and clubs to help pay their bills, we're reminded that piano technicians have faced those same challenges. From member station WBUR, Andrea Shea has the story of one piano tuner in Boston who's something of a barometer on the pandemic-battered live music industry.
Fred Mudge has been tuning pianos for about three decades.
Three things throw a piano out of tune: playing it, temperature, and humidity.
Mudge has prepared instruments for concerts with some big names.
Paul Simon, Aretha Franklin, Peter Gabriel, James Taylor and Carole King, Red Hot Chili Peppers, lots of piano tunings.
Also for piano legends like Billy Joel, Stevie Wonder, and Dave Brubeck. From the early 90s, he tuned for the late Chick Corea, who praised Mudge during a show at a Boston jazz club in 2018.
Actually, you know, the piano technician is like 80% of the piano. You can have a great piano and it not prepared well, and it's a dog.
The guitarist gets to tune in between songs. So does the violin and the cello. They have four strings or six strings. I have 230.
But Mudge hasn't tuned at a live music venue in more than a year. On this day, he's meticulously tweaking strings inside a black Yamaha Grand at a recording studio near Boston. Mudge hasn't been here in months.
December 7th.
Before the pandemic, this place was a weekly stop on a typical workday that often began at 6 a.m. in some local high school.
Anywhere and everywhere that they've got a piano with strings that needs to be tuned, I've made it a policy not to say no. Whether it's a junk box or a 9-foot concert grand, it all pays the bills.
At least it did before 2020.
The first 2 months of the pandemic, when everything shut down, I had no tuning work, zero, none. I laid everybody off, put my whole staff on unemployment. At the time, I was even thinking I'd get a part-time job at a supermarket or something just to be able to support my family.
Mudge says he lost about $60,000 over the past year. His company received PPP loans, and he was able to bring back four of his eight employees. Now the bulk of Mudge's business is coming from private clients, mostly piano teachers working remotely from home, combined with a new revenue stream, selling restored pianos.
And due to COVID, I am sanitizing the keys.
Mudge worries about the future of the live music industry, with arenas, clubs, and restaurants being silenced for so long. Many have shut down for good. While he's been able to survive, his heart goes out to colleagues whose careers have been upended.
The engineers, the backline technicians, the roadies as they're called, the lighting technicians, the stage managers, the production managers, they're completely out of work.
Then there's the musicians, like pianist Yoko Miwa, who just arrived for a video session. She had a weekly residency at a now-shuttered Boston restaurant.
Beautiful French restaurant.
We played there for like 15 years. Financially, we are hurt.
Miwa is grateful for her teaching job at Berklee College of Music and now to be able to play the Yamaha prepared by Mudge. During the pandemic, she attempted to tune her own piano at home.
Of course, it's not easy. It was really bad.
We usually laugh when someone says they tried to tune their own piano. Sounds like a piano again. The best part of my job is when I finish tuning for a pianist like Yoko or someone, and they sit down and try it out. And they are inspired.
I love it. I love it. Beautiful.
The piano tuner looks forward to the music scene coming back to life now that some venues can reopen at reduced capacity around here. Mudge says things are looking up, but there's still plenty of uncertainty.
Yesterday I was driving by the Boston Garden and there was an advertisement for Justin Bieber in July, which definitely gives us hope. But you can't do a big production of the Rolling Stones or something with a whole bunch of 18-wheelers and crew and that sort of thing to 25% of an audience.
One thing Mudge does know for sure is there are a lot of out-of-tune pianos out there.
There are, and I'm looking forward to the time when we can come back and go full force at this. I'm a little worried that if everybody calls it once, we could be inundated.
But the tuner says that would be the right problem to have. For Here and Now, I'm Andrea Shea.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.